You are. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a war over words going on in American public schools. Commissars of the politically correct left on one side, the Praetorian Guard of conservative American morality on the right. They've all got their red pens and their fine-tooth combs, and word by word, they are poring over school books, effectively banishing anything and everything that may be objectionable, offensive, insensitive, or arguably immoral. Increasingly, kids don't read about cleaning ladies or busboys, about abortion or evolution. Children today, says our guest tonight, are served up sanitized school books where words, images, and ideas have been censored by school boards and sensitivity committees. The result, argues Diane Ravitch, is light and fluffy textbooks that have little bearing on the reality American children see the moment they leave the classroom. Pressure groups are squeezing schools and educational materials harder. Publishers are going along. Is all this really creating the society Americans want and the education children deserve? Is it censorship? Are we scrubbing our way to an enlightened state or a state of ignorance? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Diane Ravitch, author of The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. She's former Assistant Secretary for Educational Research and Improvement at the U.S. Department of Education and is currently Research Professor of Education at New York University. Good evening and welcome, Diane Ravitch.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks so much for joining us.
That was a great summary of my book. I wish I'd been able to write that.
Oh, well, we're all done then. Also with us in the studio tonight is On Point News Analyst Randall Kennedy, Professor of Law at Harvard University and author of Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption, and Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. Wonderful to have you back, Randall Kennedy.
Thank you very much.
Diane Ravitch, you've put so much on the table here. When we want to dig in tonight, I want to make sure that we've got your case out there first. I mean, it raises lots of big questions, but first just tell us, you say that there is a huge scandal in American education. What is it?
The scandal is that the materials that children encounter, tests and textbooks, are carefully screened by what's now called bias and sensitivity review committees. It's very, very rigorous for testing, and everything is, and it's slightly less rigorous for textbooks, although even that's carefully screened. But everything that is offensive to anyone or potentially offensive to anyone is removed. And the people who get offended are in from all sides. It's people on the right who object to evolution, who object to stories about dysfunctional families or disobedient children, who object to fantasy and witchcraft. It's people on who are feminists who object to words that they consider gender biased, and it's people from representing the disabled groups who say they don't want to have words that they don't like. It's people who claim to be representing the elderly, although you're not supposed to say the elderly. There are all sorts of language bans on words that I see every day in the daily newspaper that you will not see in either in textbooks or on standardized tests.
Diane Ravitch, we've been having fun with the lists that fill to overflowing the glossary and at the back of your book, but give us some examples so that our listeners can have a sense of
sure.
the range and types of words, phrases that are being combed out by bias and sensitivity committees.
Well, what I found was that every publisher of textbooks or tests, and sometimes they're the same, has a list of words that the writers are not supposed to use. They're told to avoid these words, which means don't use them.
So the list you're giving us here is not like one universal list that no publisher uses, but these are words that one publisher or another
right.
has decided to avoid or been told to avoid.
Exactly.
Okay.
In some case, many publishers, for instance, every publisher bans a word like businessman. Every publisher bans salesman. Every word that ends in M-A-N is banned by everybody.
M-A-N or B-O-Y or
right.
even G-I-R-L. It looks to me from your list like all of these are out, out, out. Cowboy,
well, exactly.
cowgirl, busboy, craftsman, and on and on. Out.
Exactly. But it gets particular. For instance, several publishers ban the word brotherhood. Now, I thought that was a good word, but that's banned.
What's it replaced with?
It's replaced with amity, unity, or community. And I don't think any of those has quite the same sound to me. It doesn't have the same feeling. And, you know, one of our national songs, I forget, right now I can't remember which one it is, sings, "And crown thy good with brotherhood." Well, you know, that's...
We all know that one. So gender prefixes and suffixes are out. What else is on the out list?
ETS, the Educational Testing Service, has a long list of words that it bans that are particular to the ETS test. And that would be like, for instance, the SAT. So you're not supposed to use words. They will not use words like extremist, fanatic, dogma, cult, heretic. Those are all considered ethnocentric words.
Extremist is ethnocentric. I don't hear ethnicity of that word.
Right. Well, it's not about ethnicity. It's about it's chauvinist. That if you call someone an extremist, they may think you're an extremist. So who's to say who the real extremist is? So don't call anyone an extremist.
So this is an embrace of moral relativism or something like that. Who can say who's out of bounds?
They don't explain it. Actually, extremist is banned by Scott Forsman. I mean, I have to go through my list to say who did the banning. Extremist is banned by Scott Forsman, Addison Wesley.
But this is an attempt to protect the views that one group may call extremist and the group itself may think it's just right. It's just
the,
right
the group
smack dab
would
in the
say
middle.
We're not extremists, we're believers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the ETS would bans the word cult.
So there's another continent, which is anything that would describe extremes of belief, you're saying is kind of toned down and made to sound less objectionable.
You're not allowed to use the word.
Okay. What else?
As I said, the word cult is banned by ETS, but it's also banned by Scott Forsman. And then any word that refers to, let's say, people with disabilities has to be rearranged. So you would not say the deaf. And this was, many publishers banned this term, the deaf. You're supposed to say people who are deaf.
All right. And that right on across the spectrum of I'm not sure what word to use, disabilities or handicaps.
Right. Or you would not say the blind. You would say people with a visual disability. I mean, everything becomes very cumbersome, and virtually every publisher bans the term the blind. And then you're not supposed to say the word courageous to refer to someone who has a disability. You would not, for instance, say Steve Reeves is a very courageous man because he's become an advocate for people with disabilities.
Christopher Reeves.
Christopher Reeves. He's not courageous. He's not inspirational. He's just a guy who's in a wheelchair.
And so that leaves us, and I'm reading down your list here, just jumping into the Fs of words on the kind of no-no list. Fair sex, factory foreman, fairy, fanatic, fat, feeble-minded, fellow worker, fellowship, feminine wiles, filly. Filly, isn't that just a female horse?
Right. Well, you can. McMillan McGraw-Hill says you can use it to refer to a female horse, but you can't refer to a woman. I mean, I don't know that anyone actually refers to a woman as a filly. Some of these words are obsolete anyway. And, you know, my view of this whole list of words that are banned is many of them would disappear just in the normal course of events, or some of them might. I mean, I don't hear people calling old women crones. Are calling old men codgers.
I've heard crone embraced lately among the women who walk dogs with me in the morning. Well, at a certain age, maybe you embrace it. Maybe I'd embrace codger.
Well, you know, like the word girl. I went to college many years ago, and my friends and I, we went to a women's college. We call each other the girls.
I don't think
that's offensive.
Take us back. What's the origin of this impulse to card out the language, to comb out the language?
Well, in the late 60s, early 70s, the NOW and other feminist groups wanted to make the language gender neutral. And there are a lot of words in the English language that are not gender neutral. So it created an opportunity to say you can't say man hours. You can't say that a lake is a man-made lake. You know, long list of words that start with man and long list of words that end with man. And then it gets to be... Then they began looking for phrases like the distaff side. Again, a phrase that I've never heard anyone actually use. But all of these are banned by one or more publishers.
And you go back even further, you say, to the effort to draw racism out of American educational materials.
Well, certainly there was an effort, and the initial bias review was make sure that there were no racist references. And I think that what happened over time was all the racist references or anything that might be interpreted as racist or anything that would really be interpreted as gender bias was removed, but the bias and sensitivity review committees did not disappear, so they had to find new kinds of bias. And so they began finding bias like regional bias, so that when I was serving on a test committee, and I still serve on the same test committee, it's a federal testing panel, we were reviewing fourth grade passages for a national test. And a test question that took place in the mountains was considered regionally biased because children who had never lived in the mountains couldn't answer a question about some events that occurred in the mountains.
So the sensitivity gets turned up very high. You've got just zillions of fascinating examples here. But I really feel a fascinating also kind of structure beneath this. And I want to get into it tonight because, Dayton Ravitch, I wonder, do you object to every single objection raised to words? Isn't there a fundamental tension here between society's desire to kind of move forward, if you accept the idea of progress, mm-hmm. and old language that is all bound up with ideas from a past that includes a lot of things we may want to leave behind?
Well, you know, where I stand personally is that I use gender-neutral language, and I don't use very many of the words on this list because my own instinct as a writer is to be gender-neutral, and it's not because I have a list that I work from. And I do believe that language does evolve and that there are words that were used 30 years ago and 50 years ago and 100 years ago that die a natural death, and that's probably as it should be. And it's as a writer, I just object to the idea that somebody has to give people a list and say you're never to say founding fathers.
But textbooks last a long, long time. They shape the minds of the youngest Americans. Isn't that a place, if there's any place, where we might want to pay attention?
Well, yes, but not. I find this list to be problematic. I mean, there are a lot of words on it where I would say, well, I don't really care if that word disappears because a lot of them have already disappeared. They're obsolete words. But, you know, why should heiress disappear? I mean, there is a Henry James, I think it's Henry James play, The Heiress.
Heiress, she who inherits.
Right. Exactly. Well, okay, and there are other references where you might want young people to know what these words are. And I don't think it's demeaning to refer to a young woman who has inherited a fortune as an heiress. I don't think it's demeaning to Vanessa Redgrave to call her an actress. I just think that most actresses like being called actresses.
Randall Kennedy, jump in here with us. You've paid a lot of attention to words. You took on a very loaded word in your book, Nigger. Here we've got a huge menu of words that are, by one publisher or another, by one testing service or another, put out of bounds. What do you make of this?
Well, what I make of it is that in the language police, our guest has certainly shown us how officials around the country have come to, in many instances, quite stupid conclusions with respect to language and with respect to other aspects of public education. And in that sense, I think that this book provides a great service. I do think, however, that beneath that, there are some real difficulties. For instance, this issue of censorship. Ms. Ravitch, I'd be interested in knowing...
Please call me Diane, and let me say that I'm honored to have you on the program, Randall. I've admired your work for a long time.
Well, thank you very much.
And I can't say the name of your last book.
Okay. Well, that's okay. But tell us, what is censorship? Because that's a key word in your new book. But I think it's a very difficult word to grapple with, particularly in the context of public education.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me give you an example of what I think censorship is. I keep getting stories from people who work in this industry who email me and say, tell me things that they've seen. And one thing that I came across recently was a Scottish children's writer who wrote and illustrated a story and sold it to an American textbook company. And it was illustrated with a picture of a little girl sitting on her grandfather's lap. And the textbook publisher said, we can't use this illustration. It implies incest. Mm. And so she had to change the illustration to make it a little girl sitting on her grandmother's lap. I don't know if this is just evil-minded people who see these things, but that strikes me. There's something at work there that's probably part of a guideline that I haven't seen, mm-hmm. that little girls can't be sitting on a lap of a man, a father or grandfather or relative.
Is there anything you would like to see or you think should be seen as off-limits in American textbooks?
Oh, I think that there are issues of developmental appropriateness. I mean, you don't you can't teach Hemingway to third graders or Shakespeare to fourth graders. But I think that the decisions ought to be made by teachers and in schools. And I think the teachers, the best teachers, are using not textbooks, but real real literature.
Diane Ravitch, stand by. We've got to take a short break. You can see a list of some of the banned words we're talking about here at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the language police and the war over words in America's schools. My guest is Diane Ravitch, joining us from Washington. She is author of a new book, The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. I'm also joined tonight by our news analyst tonight, Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University. You can join this conversation as well. Do you read your children's textbooks? Do they look like censored documents to you? Has political correctness gone too far in controlling what Americans read, say, and learn? And can we comb out every offensive word and still have a culture when we're done, still understand history? On the other hand, can a society progress without its language changing? And is it time to be done with caveman, career woman, and bus boy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Diane Ravitch, you've given us an awful lot of interesting examples here tonight, and yet I still feel this tension between a society wanting to progress, wanting to move past some old and perhaps destructive ideas, and your sort of laissez-faire attitude saying, let the teacher handle it. But, of course, the teacher's going to be given a textbook. Someone's paying attention to what's in there.
Let me say, Tom, that what I object to is this idea that somewhere behind the scenes, really outside of public view, there are people working with lists that the public did not create. I don't know who created these lists. They were put together over time by people who have extremes, you know, from left, right, and all sorts of groups.
But aren't they representatives of the public one way or another?
No, they're not. No one elected them.
Randall Kennedy.
Well, but presumably, even if they were elected, you would object to certain of the things that you put forward.
Absolutely. I don't want somebody telling me I can't write the word cowboy or cowgirl. I think that's stupid.
Right. But in your book, let me push you a little bit on this.
Sure.
Because you began your book by saying that in the 60s, the effort to weed out sexism and racism of a very rank and open sort was entirely reasonable and justified.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then later and throughout the book, you say that you're against censorship. Now, let's imagine that we have someone who puts forward a manuscript that has sexist imagery, racist ideas in it, and you come to the conclusion, no, I don't want the children in this district to read that book. Isn't that censorship? Isn't that good censorship?
Isn't that sensible censorship?
You know, I think it's a judgment. What I don't like is the judgment being made at the source. I don't like that publishers have decided, and this is virtually every publisher, that the word housewife is banned. I was a housewife myself for 20 years, and I'm not ashamed to say I was a housewife. I don't think that's a sexist term. I think it's a description of the role that I played in my family.
Right, but in that instance, the censorship is wrong. I mean, the United States government today in Iraq is making sure that Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party and all of that is out of the books over there. I would suppose that anybody who wanted to infiltrate the schools here with, let's say, neo-Nazi literature would find themselves arrayed against a type of censorship, if you want to call it that.
Right.
Isn't that good?
Well, but you see, you know, if you don't mind my calling you Randall,
sure.
I think that there's nothing on the list that I have that represents racist or sexist talk. This is all somebody's idea of carrying it to another level. And there are no racist slurs. There are no ethnic slurs. There's no really bad words.
Well, are you so sure about that? I mean, some words that sound very familiar to us may be received as racist slurs. One of the words I'm looking at here is Hottentot. There's an indigenous name for this group of people in Africa. If they find this name offensive, is it offensive?
Well, except that there's only one place that bans that. None of the other publishers do. And again, I don't think that I've ever seen that word in a textbook, and I don't really know what the linguistic argument about that particular word is.
I take it, it's a name that was laid on by colonialists, and maybe people don't like it. But I think the point here is, Diane Ravitch, are there not degrees? I mean, you're saying flat out censorship in the schools, whatever its purposes, is censorship. It should be abhorrent to those who care about freedom of thought. And we can hear that. But But is there not some turf in which a society, when it's thinking about raising its children, needs to talk about words and what words work and what don't?
These are not the words. I mean, the words that you would think of as deserving of censorship would be words that would be ethnic slurs, and yet you will, our children and all of us will encounter those words when we read good literature.
Well, take one word on your list for
Steinbeck and in Hemingway and in and a lot of the very important writers of the 20th century.
Yeah, here's a very simple one you have on your list: caveman. What is lost in moving from caveman to cave dweller?
I don't really care. I don't think it makes any difference. But as a writer, don't want to be told by a publisher that I'm not allowed to use that word. I don't want a publisher to start with a list and say these words have been ruled out of the English language. I think the English language does a very good job of evolving and dropping words all by itself without publishers saying this word is off the table.
And take us to the end game there, Diane Ravitch. If this trend continues and this list grows and grows, or even if it just stays where it is, what's your sense beyond your kind of philosophical objection to censorship, which we can understand? What's your sense of what it does to the culture, to the heart of the education these children get?
I think what it does is that it sends a message to children that what they're getting in school is not only unrealistic because of especially the image banning, which we haven't even gotten into, but that it is sugar-coated and that they're increasingly drawn to the more outspoken kinds of popular culture, because certainly what they're getting on the Internet and in their videos and in their music is totally uncensored, and so they're getting this kind of unrealistic world in school, and I think it makes them cynical, and it's also very boring.
Randall Kennedy, it is quite an image of kids stepping out of their junior high school classroom, putting on the earphones, and then getting hip-hop and everything else with, you know, the whole world going on. Where's the middle way, or is there a middle way here? Would you make it kind of a laissez-faire environment, as Diane Ravitch says? She says, let teachers deal with it in each classroom.
I don't think that's what she's saying, actually. She's on the line with us and can break in. I think what she's saying is there are many, many, many examples where people have drawn lines in an indefensible way. And to that extent, I'm wholly in agreement. The place where I guess I'm a little bit still, I'm quizzical, is her suggestion sometimes that there is not a line to be drawn.
I think there's a line to be drawn, and I would agree with you about that. I think that somehow, because of all the pressures that both the State Departments of Education and the test makers and the publishers have been subject to, they have drawn the line wherever they get one or two or three letters. And that is not representatives of the public. That is any crank that writes in can get a test question dropped, and that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. And pretty soon we've got an education system that is losing a lot of vocabulary. Listeners, you can join this conversation. Can a society progress without its language changing? Is it time to be done with caveman, career woman, and busboy? Do censored textbooks create enlightened children or ignorant children? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Barbara's on the line. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just struck by how when I was in school and studying English literature from, you know, centuries ago, that the professors were always sort of educating us about how language was used in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And then my recollection of living in that time of the late 60s and through the 70s and the women's movement and there being an impetus for language evolution, a conscious evolution of language toward being more respectful and more inclusive.
Of women?
Initially
and then more, yes.
Well, it might have been prompted by the women's movement. It might have been prompted by the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it's hard to separate those in time.
So where do you stand now? Are you glad for that? Do you want to see that represented in our children's textbooks and testing?
I think there's plenty of room for variety, and no matter what's in the textbooks, children are going to hear a variety of language styles, and, you know, God knows these days kids hear a language of, many more countries probably in the course of a week than I did when I was growing up.
But Barbara, at a very simple level, I'm just curious, here you are, representative as the caller, do you want to see words banned on a gender basis like craftsman, fireman, garbageman, or not?
Banned? No.
Cut out of textbooks. It's the same thing, but sounds less fierce.
I think it's fine for them to be out of textbooks because they're going to be encountered anyway.
You think it's fine for them to be in the book, or you say let them be banished from the textbook?
I think it's fine for them to be out of the text because mm-hmm. they're going to be used in vernacular language or encountered in the media or historical texts.
And overall, are you then suggesting, Barbara, that you're happy for this movement to reexamine language and weed out language that perpetuates stereotypes?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I just think it's natural. I mean, it's happened throughout time. Why should this time be any different?
Barbara, thanks for your call. Diane Ravitch.
Okay, I don't think it is. What they're doing is not natural. This is not a natural evolution. The process that's grown up over the last 25 years is an institutionalized censorship program in which a stereotype would be, let's say, representing an African-American as a great athlete. Now, that's just reality. There are, you know, to say you can't do that representation is absurd, but that's a stereotype. A stereotype would be an Asian-American student who's a superb student. That's a stereotype. You can't write about that.
Are you saying then that, for example, in textbooks they'd have guidelines that would say do not show African-American
yes.
athletes?
Yes. And stories have been removed because they were about great African Americans, because they represented African Americans as outstanding athletes or entertainers. Stories have been removed and representations have been redone because they showed old people who were old, who right. were feeble, who were sickly. And, you know, that's part of the natural aging process. As we get older, we sometimes do get sickly. And so to not represent that is just dishonest.
Randall Kennedy, you can feel the aspiration here to move beyond stereotypical images. At the same time, when you get to formulas, everybody starts to feel queasy.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it the case that the educational system at one point was totally indifferent, frankly, to stereotypes, where every Chinese person you saw had to do with a laundry, where every yeah. black person you saw had to do with sports. And so isn't it to some extent an effort to undo true stereotyping that maybe people are going overboard?
Diane Ravitch?
I think it is going overboard. And I think that the textbooks, if you were to go back and look at the textbooks from, let's say, the early 20th century, or certainly before that, or the mid-20th century, you would see stereotypes. But now there is a counter-stereotype in which everyone is exactly the same.
Everything is bland, as you described.
You would not see an old person who appeared old, and you know, all of these images mm-hmm. In which people appear in real life would not appear. And rather than being inclusive and representing diversity, everything is homogenized.
I understand your point. Richard Hofstadter once said, however, that every good point should be able to bear the pressure of overstatement. Couldn't it be that what these educators are doing is essentially giving maybe an overdose of medicine, but they're overdosing, but they really did have a problem on their hand, didn't they? And still, maybe, still have a problem on our hands?
You are discussing this as though it's a rational response to a problem, whereas the problem that existed, I believe, and I argue in my book, was in fact solved 20 years ago, or 25 years ago. What we're dealing with now is the hyperactivity of pressure groups of all kind, whose every objection gets incorporated into bias guidelines. And there are now bias and sensitivity review committees who sit down and go through every tech story and every testing story looking for things that they call bias that no one else would call bias. And I give in the beginning of the book some examples of this, the story, for instance, of the owl hunting its prey. Mm-hmm. And then the bias and sensitivity reviewers say, you can't have a story about an owl because an owl is a taboo creature to a certain Indian tribe or Native American tribe. And so American children will never again see owls on a standardized test.
And so out go the owls. Listeners, what do you think? Right. What have you seen in your lives? Kim is calling from Dedham, Massachusetts. Hi, Kim. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that, first of all, according to my niece's current textbook,
right.
the Alamo was fought between Hispanics and Texans. And since that's not actually the way it happened, it kind of confuses me.
You mean Mexico being left out of that formulation?
Right. Apparently, they are not Mexicans any longer. They are Hispanics.
Right.
And that's a little confusing when you start talking to someone and say, well, when Mexico fought this war, and they're like, well, it wasn't Mexico. Yes, it really was.
Well, I'm not sure I even – Diane Ravitch, come in with us. How can you figure how that – what impulse would have led to substituting Hispanic for Mexican? I'm not sure I see that.
Actually, I grew up in Texas, and for some reason, the Hispanic Americans don't want to be called Mexican Americans. They want to be called Hispanic Americans. And while I have no issue with that at all, what I don't understand is how this relates to the people actually in Mexico.
So, Kim, in your view, here you've got an interest that spills over to the point where facts of history become obscured.
Well, this probably was the case that bias and sensitivity reviewers saw the reference to Mexicans and said, let us change this to Hispanics. I mean, a lot of these things I can't explain because even in the list of stereotypes are words that you're not allowed to use. I don't understand why they're banned, and I can't explain them. And I can't explain a change like that, but I would think that that would have come out of a bias and sensitivity review.
Robert's calling from Boston. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to agree with Mr. Ravitch. You know, I don't think that this is an educational argument. I think that this is a political argument, and that the last bastion of freedom might not be the western slope of Alaska, but rather it might be our own minds. And controlling language, you control people's thoughts. And I think it's a terrible movement, and I don't think that words should be banned. There's nothing natural about banning language. Language should proceed on its own.
But is there anything at all, Robert, in your view, that ought to be left behind when a new textbook is put out that's going to last for 10 or 15 or 20 years?
If something is proven not to be true, it should be left behind. But you should not be taking out words like founding fathers or controlling the images that people see. The world is what it is. And, you know, let children learn what the world is.
Robert, thanks for your call.
If I may, Tom, let me just give an example of how this affects history books. Mm-hmm. I went through the history books to try to see how different controversial issues were dealt with, and one of them was the treatment of Iran. What did they say about Iran since the Ayatollahs took over in 1979? One or two of the world history books deal with it in a relatively straightforward way. Most of them, however, never explain what a theocracy is. None of them explain the position of women well, and most
because
of them,
why? Because it would be disparaging to Iranians,
yes,
in their view?
Because all of these world history books have a multicultural advisory committee in which they don't want to offend anybody. And whereas they'll be very hard on Hitler and Stalin because their regime is dead, if the regime continues like Mao's regime in China or the Iranian regime, they will soft shoe around it. And there are actually textbooks today, world history textbooks, that say that the Iranian Revolution of 1979 expanded job opportunities for women.
Randall Kennedy, we've just got 30 seconds before the break, but are we pushing into la-la land with the best of intentions or warped intentions here?
Well, certainly in some places. I mean, the examples that are given in the Language Police are ones that should cause all of us a lot of concern. There's no two ways about it.
We're looking tonight at The Language Police and the War Over Words in America's Schools. My guest is Diane Ravitch, author of The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. You can join the conversation as well. Do censored textbooks create enlightened children or ignorant children? Should sexist, racist, offensive words be banned from textbooks? Where would you start? Where would you stop? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about The Language Police and the War of Words in America's Schools. My guest tonight is Diane Ravitch. She's author of The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. And our news analyst tonight in the studio with me, Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University. You are welcome to join this conversation as well. Do you read your child's textbooks? Do they look like censored documents to you? Should sexist, racist, offensive words be banned from textbooks? Where would you start? Where would you stop? And how much language policing is enough? Is any too much? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kara's calling from Dracut, Massachusetts. Hi, Kara.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is I keep the phrase keeps going through my head, those who do not know their history are doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, I mean, I understand them taking this language out. We don't want to be, you know, promoting this as the way to be exactly. But I really wouldn't mind leaving the language in, provided because it provides the teacher an opportunity to begin a discussion about racism, or this was the old word we used. This is now, you know, this is now the new word we use. And when we remove those words, we've taken away all their chances at any serious intellectual discussion about how bad it used to be.
Or at least have a glossary of all the old stuff at the back that you can refer to, because everything can be kind of just turned into pastel, deracinated here, Carol.
Tom, if I can make the point, I certainly agree with the caller. Most of the words that I found as banned words from publishers' guidelines are not words that refer, that are racist words. There are very few words that would anyone would call racist. The words that are called sexist are just words that end in M-A-N. I use gender-neutral words myself, so I don't really care. But there are words banned like senile. And, you know, there are people who are senile, but the word is banned. The word sect, S-E-C-T,
mm-hmm.
is a banned word. I don't think that's a bad word. There are test makers who will not use the word snow cone because that's considered a regional biased word. I mean, the words that I have found, which are not which are the words that come out of these bias guidelines, most of them are everyday words, many of which you will see in the New York Times or the Boston Globe.
Mm. So Kara says, let it rip. Randall Kennedy, it's easy to look at some of these and say, well, that's just preposterous. But there are difficult lines to draw here, too.
I think there are difficult lines, and I'd like to put one on the table, and it involves another issue that is discussed in the Language Police, and that has to do with the question of representational fairness.
That is images.
Images. People saying, well, you have to have a certain number of women, a certain number of blacks, a certain number of Latinos.
Diane Ravitch gives the example of McGraw-Hill, which mm-hmm. dictates a 50-50 balance between sexes in their art with equal distribution of active and significant roles. So,
yeah.
So we're talking about images then. Randall Kennedy.
Okay, and obviously this, like anything else, can be taken too far, but there really are difficulties. Imagine the following. Imagine a historian who proposes a book and says, I want the students to read 10 texts or 10 essays, 10 examples of important documents in American history. And let's imagine that all 10 documents are by various sorts of Americans, but they're none by people of color.
Mm.
And then let's also imagine that one of these textbook editors or publishers says, hey, listen, we can't do this. We've got to have at least a person of color among the 10. Is that wrong?
Diane Ravitch, Randall Kennedy is now on the Sensitivity Committee, and he doesn't want an all-white list of great American thinkers to read.
It depends on what the topic is. If you were, let's say, having a collection of writings about from the Constitutional Convention, I don't think you would have anything by people of color.
Just say 10 great all-time important American documents.
I put together an anthology like that. It's called The American Reader, and I have Frederick Douglass and a variety of people of color represented in it. And I made a conscious effort to do so.
But if Randall Kennedy was on the Sensitivity Committee and he stood up looking at an all-white list and said, you know what, this just doesn't seem right in this day and age, do you think he's then becoming a censor? Is he wrong to do that?
I think it's a question of selection. And I think that, the editor should be free to put in whatever he wants to. I don't really care if there are women or blacks represented. And I think that it's just an issue of the editor's choice. And if people want, if it has a specific purpose, like to represent the founding fathers, then there will not be women represented, and there probably will not be American blacks either.
Right, but let me put a point on it, because the example I have in mind has to do with a very distinguished historian, and a historian whom I respect and like very much, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. In the last edition of his book, The Disuniting of America, he has a list of documents that everybody should know, sort of, mm-hmm. Important documents in American history. And as I recall, there are no people of color in that list. Now, my question is, of course, an editor or writer can put out anything he or she wants, but educational authorities, just suppose an educational authority says, listen, we're not going to accept that list. That list doesn't have any people of color. Frederick Douglass isn't on that list. Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King isn't on that list.
Right.
Somebody of color should be on that list. Would they be wrong?
Okay. No, he would not be wrong. That's his choice. I'm saying the editor would be wrong to tell him he has to change his list. I already put together my list. My list has Martin Luther King and Frederick Douglass and a variety, you know, William Monroe Trotter and other African Americans who made an important contribution to the American conversation.
Right, but if I'm the superintendent,
if someone else made a different choice, that's their choice.
But I'm the superintendent of schools.
Looking at a textbook.
And I say that the Ravitch book, fine. Teachers, you can use the Ravitch reader. But the Schlesinger reader, no, you can't use that. Am I wrong in saying that?
You know, I think that's a choice that can be made at the local district. What I would not like is that if a publisher were to say, Schlesinger, you're not allowed to publish your list.
Boy, it's tough, though, because books get published way upstream from that local district, and they last a long, long time. Not easy issues. Jason's calling from Fort Havelock, North Carolina. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Yes, my comments kind of go along with the last caller. Basically, I think this cleaning out of racially or ethnically biased terms in the American language really plays into the dumbing down of our society because it weakens our ability to deal with language, with unpleasantries, with reality. I think really it boils down to kind of it's kind of an issue of give a man a fish or teach him how to fish. You know, if you take away the opportunity for him to deal with it, you're feeding him the fish. But if you teach children starting out young, well, this kind of language exists, but you need to learn how to judge for yourself whether it's appropriate or not.
But Jason,
how to deal with the situation.
We got your point, and no one wants a generation of weak Americans raised who can't deal with any kind of discordant idea. But aren't textbooks also teaching?
That's exactly what they're getting.
Well, but on the other hand, I guess I'll put it to you as well, Diane Ravitch.
They're not getting debate. They're not getting controversy. They're getting a sanitized, censored version of American history and of world history. Mm. And the literature is being cleaned up in order to prettify everything. We get to the question of can kids read Huckleberry Finn? And it's a difficult book, mainly because of the language, but it's a very important book. And I think kids have to read it, and they have to read it without censorship.
But isn't there a difference between choosing or not choosing a book like Huckleberry Finn and looking at the very language of the textbooks itself? If the textbooks were to use the same language as Huckleberry Finn uses to describe the issues of that day, wouldn't that be inappropriate, Diane Ravitch?
Let me say that I at the end of my book, I have a recommendation. Hmm. And one of them is that I think that states should not adopt textbooks because I think that's where the pressure groups get their leverage from. And the odds of of the states like California and Texas paying attention to me are very slender. The other recommendation, however, is that there has to be a tremendous amount of transparency. I don't say let's end bias and sensitivity review. What I say is let's make it public. Let's have a website where every state that does this, and every state is now doing it,
yeah,
and every test maker and every text publisher should put out on their website what are the banned words.
Well, that sounds great.
So
at least it's out there.
Yes, and so that if there are things that are totally ridiculous, we can say this is absurd, and that people who don't like censorship can have as much right to complain about it as the handful of zealots who put these words on a list.
Jason in North Carolina, thanks for your call, because this dumbing down issue, nobody wants to go there, Randall Kennedy.
Well, I would agree with everything that Diane just said, although here's one thing. One of the most egregious instances of what Diane seems to be railing against occurred in full light of day. And the United States Congress a number of years ago put down an ultimatum to the Smithsonian, telling the Smithsonian wanted to put on an exhibition about the dropping of the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And it was put together by a number of historians. There were various veterans groups who...
This was with the Enola Gay.
The Enola Gay exhibition. Mm-hmm. There were a number of veterans groups that objected to this portrayal of American history. Controversial, to be sure, but it would have been a good starting place for
because
good discussion.
Because it showed Americans dropping a nuclear bomb on people.
It questioned the United States' action in dropping those atomic bombs. The United States Congress said, listen, you put on this exhibition, we'll turn off the money. The exhibition was scrapped. This had to do with public education.
Mm-hmm.
I take it that you would have viewed this as a bad thing, right?
That's politics, and that's exactly what I object to now with the textbooks, is the textbooks are being politically written. I was on a talk show the other night, and someone called in from Texas, and he said he went to the Texas State Board hearings, and he had 100 objections to a particular story
and the State Board of Education accepted 87 of his objections, and the story was rewritten by the publisher. I don't think that museum exhibits or that textbooks ought to be written in either in Congress or in state legislatures.
Hmm. Joanne's calling from Truro, Massachusetts. Hi, Joanne. You're on the air.
Hi, and hi to Randy Kennedy. I'm Joanne Barkin, and I'm on the Dissent editorial board with Randy.
Hello, how are you?
Good,
great, great.
Thank you.
What's on your mind, Joanne?
Well, I've been writing these, I've been writing stories for textbooks for over 20 years now. I do a lot of writing for educational publishing. And at the very beginning when I began, which is in about 1980, everyone understood that a lot of these taboos came out of the textbook adoptions for Texas, especially the two
right.
biggest the two biggest buyers of textbooks are California and Texas.
And Texas is a very conservative market, and California probably otherwise, but both
right.
very influential.
Right, but they made the same textbook for Texas and California,
yeah.
and it was Texas that set the limit.
And what was the influence?
Well, this is one of my favorite ones. A lot of them come of these restrictions come in art specs, because as a writer you have to put down an art description for every page of the book.
That is, what kind of illustration or photograph would go here or there?
Right, exactly. And so one of our rules was that we could spec for, and this is also for the artist, of course, that animals could be depicted either completely naked or fully dressed.
I'm sorry, animals?
Animals. Like if you have an animal fantasy story.
Oh, I see.
Peter
yes.
Rabbit. Okay,
right.
Peter
you
Rabbit.
You could have a turtleneck on the rabbit or
well,
not.
Well, no, that's not it.
Oh, I see.
Peter Rabbit can either be completely without clothes, or he has to wear a top and bottom. But he cannot wear a top alone. And
I never thought of a naked animal before. I mean, can animals be naked?
And if you have a cow, it cannot have teats.
Yes. You know, you're supposed to de-emphasize them. But in any case,
I mean,
think of Donald Duck. Donald Duck always wore a shirt. He didn't wear a bottom.
Oh, yeah.
Which, of course, you know, becomes completely obscene. And I actually have in front of me my latest list of publishing taboos from one of the educational publishers.
Make it quick, Joanne, because we're running out of time here.
You can't show wine glasses or champagne glasses.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to depict any male with his hands in his pockets.
Well, obviously.
Right. I had all of these photographs from the publishers of what you cannot show. And another is showing a sweaty person or showing poverty in the third world.
Right. And under the banned words are crazy.
Mm-hmm. That's
hate,
in my list.
Hate. Poor to describe a person's economic circumstance.
Joanne, we're almost out of time. Do you find it more difficult to write text material under these circumstances? Can you write things that matter with these restrictions still?
Well, like on this list, snowballs are out. And I, you know, if if I had to write a story about, you know, it's snowing and in winter, and when I write, you know, just my own books for
snowballs
publishers.
Snowballs is out. With that one, the guidelines lose me. Joanne, thanks. Our time is running down, but thanks for your call. Diane Ravitch, where do you think this is headed? Is there any move to turn this around? Are you the move?
I'm hoping that it's headed towards public outrage and towards transparency, so that the kinds of guidelines that were just described and that I describe in The Language Police can be known to the public, and that the ridiculous ones can be thrown away.
Diane Ravitch is research professor of education at New York University and author of The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. Diane, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Randall Kennedy, how are you processing all this tonight? I mean, there's a lot here.
There is a lot here. I think on the one hand that the examples that have been discussed should alert the public that there's a big subject that they ought to be more attentive to. At the same time, I do think that there's some real difficulties in figuring out what should be part of public education and what should not be part of it.
Maybe it's not all just censorship, but we really want to pay attention. Dumbing down sounds bad, and some of these examples just leave you scratching your head. Snowballs?
Line drawing is very difficult.
It is indeed. Randall Kennedy, thank you for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can read a list of words discussed in Diane Ravitch's book, The Language Police, on our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're